if that does occur, it doesn't mean inflation goes back to 2%. In my mind, if we go down that route, that's when we get deflation. That's when we massively overshoot. If everyone gets laid off, everyone gets laid off. Prices really go down for everything, and it's ugly.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with Rabobank analyst Michael Every. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion with Michael, in which he explains how efforts by the rest of the world to de-dollarize could lead to an implosion of the global economy damaging to all nations, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. All right, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Michael Every.
What kind of odds do you see of a recession, I'll say in the US, but you can also opine globally if you think it's going to hit different parts of the globe differently?
I think that's a genuine risk. Absolutely. Central banks won't say it, but that's what they have been doing until they chicken out, like Australia. But it's going to be difficult to achieve, to come slightly full circle, unless you get rising unemployment. And after firms having got their fingers burnt so significantly during COVID, most of them appear to be hoarding labor, because they know if they get rid of them, it's going to be really hard to get them back. And in fact, what you are seeing is you have to give a big pay bump to get people back once you've let them go. So everyone's thinking, let's just hold on and try and ride this out. Well, as long as everyone does that, You don't get the layoffs, you don't get the collapse in spending. The only avenue it could come from is what you alluded to, which is to say, okay, yeah, bank lending dries up. Now that is a real risk. That's a real risk. That's potentially where you get the acronyms coming in as well. That's where the central bank says, well, we don't want to see bank lending drying up, because that's the last thing we want to see. We'd like to see consumers maybe spending at a 5% pace, not a 7% pace, or whatever it is to be sustainable in their view. But we don't want to see banks no longer lending to people, so they'll step in with liquidity support. And then once again, you have this mixed policy message, which is going to be really, really confusing. So to summarize, I do see the risk of what you're saying. I absolutely do. But I think it's only one of multiple risks, multiple scenarios ahead. But if that does occur, it doesn't mean inflation goes back to 2%. In my mind, if we go down that route, that's when we get deflation. That's when we massively overshoot. If everyone gets laid off, everyone gets laid off. Prices really go down for everything, and it's ugly. And then, you know, what do we do in terms of interest rates? Well, I know what they'll want to do.
Right.
And then we go back to the global picture of, will emerging markets accept lots more QE dollars to buy things when they're thinking about doing barter trade with each other to say, no, thank you, we don't want to play that game. So that takes us back to that scenario. So that's one extreme scenario followed immediately by another extreme scenario.
Yep.
But that's only one to begin with.
Yeah. And just to be clear, there are a number of people on this program who believe that that is their, what they believe to be the more probable scenario here. Not saying you're saying that necessarily, but
it's a very probable scenario. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, again, it's all probabilities, right? I know that if I gave you enough time, you could come up with a bunch of other scenarios that are non-zero in terms of, you know, ones that we should be thinking about. Well, I guess let me ask this. What I'm going to get to is, you know, are there assets that you think are well positioned for this highly uncertain environment, and others you wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole? But before I ask that question, 2022 was a punishing year for investors, and I'm not trying to dismiss the fact that it was a punishing year, but it wasn't. We've had worse bear markets, and as a matter of fact, there's still debate as to whether it was really a true bear market or not. I guess where I'm going here is what's the likelihood you think we could see a new low this year? Is it high, medium, or low in your crystal ball?
Okay, first caveat, I don't give investment advice, and I have to make that abundantly clear. And I certainly don't manage any money. I don't want anyone thinking I do. But if we're just having a hypothetical discussion about equities in general, I presume you're talking US equities, you know, without being specific about the index or anything. It depends what you see the Fed doing. If you see the Fed doing what you're just suggesting a moment ago, which is, okay, they'll hike till they break something, then they'll slash rates all the way back down again, we're off to the races. In fact, you know, I wrote a note as a counterbalance towards the serious geopolitical stuff that I write relatively recently. And at the end of it was just the lyrics to The Wonderful Thing About Tiggers. But it was The Wonderful Thing About Pivots. Is pivots are wonderful things. You know, basically everything's made out of rubber and springs. And if you want to believe that, fantastic. Everything's just going to go back up again. But if you see the world as being problematic in terms of the labor market, in terms of the supply of commodities, in terms of geopolitics, in terms of the breakdown of supply chains, if you see all things, these things as real, which I personally do, maybe not all of them all the time, but many of them keep popping up whack-a-mole style, then I think the problem is that there's a worrying scenario where inflation is far stickier than people think. Even if the economy gets bad, then you get elements of stagflation. Mm-hmm. And then it's far, far less clear what central banks can do, particularly when the emerging markets are looking on and saying, don't you look like emerging markets now? And what are you going to do about it? Which is, by the way, another t-shirt I wanted to get all year. DM equals EM. Developed markets now look like emerging markets. Get used to it.
Ah, that's so interesting. That's so interesting. Okay, so if we have this more complicated future, which I think you say personally you're sort of leaning towards, then you expect equities to have sort of a rough road ahead of them. How about bonds? Bonds have been super interesting because you alluded to this earlier, like you finally do have an alternative to equities, which you didn't have for such a long period of time. At least in terms of the return and safety elements, right? You could get the safety of bonds, but you weren't really getting much of a return, at least in terms of cash flow on them. And if we enter this world where maybe the Feds start monkeying stuff around again, let me put it this way: you're getting paid to sit in safety at this point. As long as inflation is coming down, you know, at some point we're not too far away from treasuries paying you at the rate of inflation, right? Maybe you'll even go above for a period of time. But even if the Fed does pivot, right, and you have this wonderful world of made of magic and springs or whatever, I forgot, bond prices should respond very favorably to a pivot. And then not only are you getting sort of paid to wait and watch what happens in all this chaos, but you kind of have this optionality upside that the market value of your bond could actually go up pretty dramatically in a short period of time if there's aggressive central bank easing policy suddenly thrown into the mix. So I'm curious, what's your overall thoughts on bonds in this scenario?
I agree. I mean, first of all, in terms of a bear market, bonds last year, that was a bear market.
Yeah.
That was like, you know, the worst year for bonds for hundreds of years. And the number of fixed income analysts who still don't want to admit how epically wrong they were, really making Taleb's point about black swans for him perfectly, that, you know, everything you would have made in bonds for your entire career, you lost in one year because you didn't see something coming because you thought it was always going to be the same as it always is. And it isn't. It never is. But what you're saying makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you're absolutely risk averse, go cash, go money market funds, because you can pick up a really juicy yield just being in a cash-like instrument. I mean, a lot of people are doing that. So I think that's a very, very good risk averse call. If you want to be in bonds, I would still suggest you probably want to be in the short end, because, you know, with the yield inversion, the short end's higher there. And if the Fed does cut, that's where they're going to come down more. You do have the downside risk that if they hike more, which, you know, that's the geopolitical risk scenario, the sticky inflation scenario, you take a capital loss there. But if you kind of average into that position, you can still be getting, you know, higher yield coming through bit by bit by bit.
Right. And you can build ladders that renew. And so you can kind of ride the rise in rates in aggregate over that period. Yep.
Absolutely. I mean, and if you take a view the other way, I think it's a more aggressive position, not one I think maybe that, you know, the retail public would look at, is you'd say, okay, so presume that they're going to keep hiking and, you know, the curve will invert and go along the 10-year. But I think, you know, that's obviously, I think that's more of a professional trade. And I think you've got to have a much firmer view that they're going to keep hiking a lot more and there isn't any institutionalized inflation. And you don't have any of the geopolitical issues happening. So you've got a spectrum of interesting trades there in the bond space. And the equity one really is, think about Tigger. And if that song is in your head, that's the way you want to go. And if that song isn't, if you're more Eeyore like myself, that may not be the way you want to go.
Okay, great. I love your analogies. They're so spot on. All right. You mentioned this asset once or twice. I'm just curious because in times of uncertainty, certainly if crisis emerges in times of stagflation, I think it tends to do well. Of course, I'm kind of building up to gold here. Thoughts on it in this environment?
It's done well of late. I understand why. If you're going to see lots more central bank buying, because certain central banks are starting to prepare for the possibility of US sanctions, which is what I think they're doing in doing that. Effectively, it's still being used as a US dollar substitute because they're not going to be selling it for ringgit or rupees. If they're going to be getting the gold, it's, you know, we'll all be going into dollar cash somewhere at some point, somewhere under the table. Let's be realistic about it. But yeah, I can see there being upside for gold to a degree in that environment. So I'm not surprised where we are now, but it still comes down to your view on what the Fed is doing on rates in this geopolitical environment. Because if you buy into this hypothesis, and I stress again, hypothesis, that the geopolitical response to all this is Bretton Woods 3, 7%, 8%, whatever it takes to kind of get commodities to collapse, that ain't good for gold. That's good for the dollar and nothing else. But if you think the response is going to be the most important thing we need to do now to take on China is to push up the stock market, I mean, how you think that can possibly happen as a logical sequitur, but, you know, we're talking about the US, so there's probably someone somewhere trying to peddle that nonsense.
Logic doesn't always apply. Yeah, exactly.
Exact. Terms and conditions may, but logic doesn't. Yeah. Then gold would be something to consider. So again, I'm not making a specific call. I'm not trying to, you know, dodge the question. I'm just giving everyone a range.
No, you're giving a realistic answer. No, I super appreciate that. And you know, again, look, we have a lot of people that come on this program, and gold tends to be a common conclusion to folks here, but it's by no means a universal one. And I want to make sure the people that are going on the Team Gold train, you know, hear what are some of the things that could throw a wrench into their plans. All right. Well, look, Michael, this has been phenomenal. Thank you. Again, like I said, I wish we had more hours. We'll just invent them in the future by bringing you back on. Lots of issues we talked about, probably a ton that are important in your mind that we didn't. I'm going to wrap up in just a second, but a concluding question here is just, is there anything else that we didn't talk about today that you think is particularly important to put on the radar of the viewers watching this video right now?
Well, we've covered a lot of ground and it's been pretty high, you know, helicopter view and pretty granular in other areas. I think just one other thing to have in mind, and I'm only floating the balloon, is if we are going to see more of a shift back towards industrial policy in the US alongside others, which I think is pretty much, if not baked into the cake, it's the recipe that we're looking at while we're in the kitchen, while assembling the ingredients. Start thinking to yourself, what do we really need in the economy? Which is, you know, it's a parallel argument to the gold one in a way, but I think it's a little bit more bread and butter or guns and butter focused in terms of what do we actually really need going forward. Now, I'm not making any calls on that, and that's a whole separate discussion, but is it, as I said, Instagram filters that make cats that like dogs? And if it is, go all in on that, and if you think it isn't, don't.
Great point. That, yeah, let me restate that and feel free to correct this, but in times of heightened, I'll say national stress, you know, countries focus on where the true priorities are. And so ask yourself, what are those priorities? And those probably where I want to be placing my bets more than what's considered a luxury or a discretionary item.
Exactly right.
Okay, great. Well, Michael, look, this has been wonderful. For the very few folks who may not have been aware of you and your work before this video, who really enjoyed this discussion, would like to follow you and your work from here, where can they go?
Well, I'm often quoted on Zero Hedge, you know, sometimes in a favorable light, sometimes not. But I'm also on LinkedIn, so you can look for me there. Apart from that, I have a relatively low social media profile because I prefer to save my ammunition for wonderful platforms like this one, where one can have a rational, reasonable, long-form debate, because I think these are important issues to discuss, and they need that care and attention to unpack them properly, which is why I always enjoy coming here, because you give me the time to do so. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. It is my privilege. So thank you. So Michael, what I'll do is I'll put, when we edit this, I'll put up Michael Every, and I'll put Rabobank as well, that folks can put into LinkedIn or Zero Hedge or Google if they want to find you. And the reason why I'm putting Rabobank up in there is one whom you work with, but also if you just type in Michael Every, you get lots of results that aren't you exactly because it's too general. All right. Well, look, this has been absolutely wonderful, Michael. Really look forward to having you back on anytime you want to come on.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, now's the time of the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisory partners by Wealthion, to hear their reaction to this great interview with Michael, as well as talk about what the markets have been up to since last week. I'm joined, as usual, by lead partners from New Harbor Financial, Mike Preston and John Lodra. Hey, guys. Mike, why don't we start with you? What were some of your key takeaways from the conversation here?
It was a good talk, Adam. Michael's a global strategist, I guess, in Singapore with Rabobank, and certainly seems to have his finger on the pulse of what's going on with the global economic system. There was a lot of talk about the Fed and what the Fed's going to do, as usual, because it's the only thing that's mattered for so very long, over 10 years. And he said that the Fed doesn't want wage inflation. I think he's probably right about that. You know, he doesn't want, or the Fed central banks don't want labor to gain some leverage over capital or over corporations. You know, that would be bad for the economy, not necessarily bad for workers, but bad for the cost of goods and bad for inflation ultimately. So they're watching very keenly those numbers. And Michael says that there's a preponderance, I think is the word he used, of central banks wanting to pause. Yet it won't be the pause that refreshes. I think that's key. A lot of market participants are really kind of rabidly looking for the pivot, hoping that we get another blow off top. We could get another blow off top. I don't know. I don't think it'll be the pivot that causes it, but it could. If a pivot happens, it's likely to be much lower on the S&P than here. I think the Fed would look at any accident in the market as an excuse to pivot. But nonetheless, Michael says that their central banks probably want the pause, but it will not be the pause that refreshes. Maybe they pause, cut a little bit. We see a little bit of an accident, and then we go right back to some kind of easing. I think he mentioned that Volcker had done this at one point. So it's a pretty tenuous situation. It wouldn't be all out bullish if that happened. He also talked about a few other things. So for instance, if we were to start trading commodities and other currencies, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the dollar stopping being the world's reserve currency. That might actually happen eventually. In my view, it would be after a deep economic crisis, maybe if we were to default on our debt, or maybe if we were to lose a war, God forbid, we could see the removal of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. But he points out that we would be going back to some kind of barter system, and it would be really messy and really inefficient. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. He talks a little bit about what he recommends and says rightly that it depends upon what the Fed does. But overall, he's very cautious about equities, thinks that they're going to have a rough road, likes bonds, but mostly on the short term. That matches what we're doing here at New Harbor. We have nearly half of our portfolio in cash or cash equivalents, which is heavily weighted on the short term in T-bills. We have a little bit in long-term bonds, 10 to 15%. And we think that nibbling there can make sense, particularly if this yield curve inverts. Just a couple other points that I wanted to throw out there, and then I'll take a pause. There's been a lot of talk in the press about large specs or large speculators being heavily short the market. And this is being pointed to as a contrarian indicator that we should expect a market bounce from here because of that. But if you look at the charts, hedge funds or large specs were very heavily net short at the last top in 2007 as well. So it's really not a good timing indicator. Sometimes the large specs get it right. And just to wrap up with a couple numbers here, the S&P is at around 4,100, up 7% year to date, up 5 weeks in a row so far. This is the fifth week. And the VIX is, so the volatility index is in zombie land at 18 to 19, 19 right now. So there's not a lot of concern here. And if you look at a chart of the S&P, the 50-day has crossed over the 200-day. So everything looks like it could be bullish, but it really is kind of no man's land. It wouldn't take much to roll over and break a lot of these short-term technical bullish indicators. And when we look through the sectors, not a lot looks great in terms of chart setting up. The only things that really look good right now are gold and the precious metal miners and technology. Technology has had a fantastic start to the year, but we'd point out that technology and the market in general have often had false starts and have basically been a bull trap. Big bounces in the midst of bear markets. We still think this is a bear market that started 15 months ago, and we're cautious, even though we're looking for opportunities. And I think I'll pause there. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Mike. John, let me let you chime in here. Feel free to riff on anything that Mike just mentioned. One of the reasons why I really enjoy having Michael on the program is, we're based here in the U.S. Most of our viewers are from the U.S. or from other English-speaking countries, native English-speaking countries. And so we do have a very Western, skew in terms of how we look at the world. And I think Michael keeps us honest in kind of, looking from outside the U.S. at global developments and giving us what may be a little bit more either an accurate view or at least a view that's not, colored by the West's tinted lenses. I'm curious, what were some of your key takeaways from Michael's perspectives on kind of the global arc of developments right now?
Yeah, I found Michael's comments very, very, very helpful and very informative. Mike and I and our team at New Harbor here, we spend our days really applying markets and economy readings and such to in an applied way for our clients' lives and their assets. Michael takes a really kind of a much bigger global macro and big picture thought process. And we find that very fascinating. It certainly informs what we do on a day-to-day basis for clients. Some of the things he talked about, for example, this struggle between capital and labor, it reminds me of a great interview that Jeremy Grantham did earlier this week. I think it was on a podcast called The Investor Podcast, aptly named. And he talked about how the last several decades, both due to distortedly low interest rates, fueling all kinds of misallocation of capital and resources, but also lax regulations. And there was a time where stock buybacks, for example, were illegal. And now we have a situation, and Jeremy takes a pretty good opposite take on this as compared to, for example, Warren Buffett, that buybacks generally have been quite unhealthy, and they've rewarded or distorted things in favor of capital at the expense of labor for decades now. So I found that was a really interesting kind of tie in to what Michael and Jeremy talked about. But again, also in the Jeremy Grantham interview, he talked about how, and this is apropos for today, because we saw a light inflation reading come in. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. And it was touched upon in Michael Every's conversation. The big question is the Fed done hiking, and are they going to start lowering interest rates because they can declare victory on inflation? History will tell us, and Jeremy Grantham points out, and I'm going to share a couple of charts here. Usually, especially when you have very significant high market valuations and looking at a recessionary type of likely environment, the Fed rate cuts after a hiking cycle are usually a very bearish outcome. So let me share a chart here, a couple of charts to kind of make that point. All right. So this is a chart. This is put together by Bank of America Research. This goes back, several decades. And it shows the blue line is the federal funds rate, basically what the Fed is attempting to control. And the vertical teal lines here show the recessionary bear market low. And it shows that typically, especially when there's a recession involved, you look at the most recent ones. There was an 8-month lag between this most recent. I think that was late 2018 when the hiking cycle was over. There was a 17-month delay between the first rate cut and the housing market bottom. In the tech bubble, there was a 20-month delay. All to say is that sometimes the rate cuts are really more of a panicked move by central banks, not a healthy one, and markets are usually in free fall. So I guess the lesson there is to kind of be careful what you wish for. Here's another. Yeah,
hey, John, real quick, yeah. Before you go off that slide, go back to it for a second. So we've been talking a lot on this program over past weeks, months, about how the market has been yearning for a central bank pivot. And the logic behind it has been, oh, because when it does, we're going to go back to the salad days of the market where everything just started, you know, going up forever again. And what this chart shows is no. when the Fed pivots, you oftentimes have a prolonged period measured at least, you know, pretty much in quarters, if not years, between the pivot and the bear market bottom, right? So the pivot actually is a sign that things are going to get worse, not better usually.
Yeah, so not only is there likely pain, you know, measured in months, but also the deepness of that pain. Jeremy Grantham, in that interview I spoke of, he talked about, you know, it's very typical for half the bear market declines in a bear market to happen after the first rate cut. And this next slide kind of gets to that. This is an average of recessionary bear markets since 1871. And it shows here, you know, roughly about a 40% on average decline. Again, this is a chart put together by B of A Research. On average, a 40% decline from the first rate cut to the trough. Now, this is an averaging, so sometimes it's worse than that. You know, averaging can kind of make things look even more benign, especially when, you know, you're as highly overvalued as we are right now. So I just wanted to kind of bring that in an applied way that, you know, we can debate all we want about is the Fed ready to cut, but let's be careful what we wish for as investors.
And right, and if we look at this chart, it looks like we are in that credit tightening's second circle there right now, right? Where we're seeing a big tightening of credit standards going on right now. Everybody's anticipating at least a Fed pause to come soon. And at some point after that, there'll be a Fed cut. So we're still very early on in this process with, if we follow this average arc of history, you know, a 40% decline still likely ahead of us if this trajectory holds true this time.
Yeah, we think so. And when you look at, again, where valuations are, we'll get to that, I'm sure, a little bit later in this talk, we can bring some data to bear on valuations and where they are and still extreme. But yeah, we think, you know, we've been preaching caution for a lot of different reasons. And this is just one additional example of why we think that's appropriate.
Okay. Well, John, you mentioned that the new CPI numbers came out this month. Where are we? We're in April now. So it's the March CPI numbers that just came out. Headline CPI dropped from 6% to 5.0%, 6.0% to 5.0%. So inflation is continuing to come down. Disinflation, as we've been saying for many, many months now, is the dominant trend. A couple of things to note about that. One is in the video released on this channel 2 days ago with Steve Hanke. You know, he made the comment, which a few others like Lacey Hunt have made recently, like at our, you know, Lacey was making it at the recent Wealthion conference, that inflation's done. Like it's all over but the waiting here. I think with Lacey, we were talking about sort of like a bull elephant that's been mortally wounded, right? You've shot it, you've mortally wounded it, but it's a big animal, it's angry, it's going to tromp around and still do a lot of damage before it dies. And we're in that process where it's still kind of rampaging, but it is mortally wounded and likely to keel over here at some point. Now, obviously, everybody's focused on it while it's still rampaging because it can do a lot of damage, but the battle is over to a certain extent. Steve's comments seem sort of prescient for today's drop in the CPI. Also, looking at the CPI, you know, the components that are still driving it, I think the biggest factor still driving it is shelter and the rents component. And that's a very lagging indicator in the CPI calculation. And, you know, for those of us who have been tracking on this program for months now, the housing numbers, you know, are definitely coming down. The housing market's definitely peaked. We're in the midst of a correction. Home prices and rents should be coming down through the rest of this year. So we're going to expect to see that gravity start weighing on the CPI much more so than it has to date. Also, the more we go along here the next couple of months, the year-over-year comparisons are going to start just bringing down CPI as well mathematically. So we would expect to see CPI continue to march down from here. You know, nobody has a guarantee of that. We'll be tracking it closely on this channel, but we are seeing the progression that we've been expecting here. Obviously, that raises questions of, oh, well, that does that increase then the chance that the Fed is going to pause at the next Fed meeting? Still TBD. I think the latest CME projections. I'll try to find them and put them up here on the screen. I think they're still predicting a rate hike next time around. But certainly, as you know, the further and faster that CPI comes down, the less the Fed's going to feel that it needs to continue hiking rates, especially if credit standards are still tightening, because as Powell said, that sort of substitutes as additional rate hikes in the story. One thing I want to get your reaction to here, Mike, is, as I mentioned, CPI came out this morning at 5%. If you look at the U.S. Treasury bill today, it's yielding 5%. We haven't seen T-bills and the CPI yield the same for I can't remember when. And we may have a period here where, you know, we're getting real positive returns on T-bills. And honestly, I can't remember the last time that happened. Can you?
I really can't, Adam. And suffice it to say, the T-bills are a very good option here. You're not really making significant real returns if T-bills and inflation are roughly about the same thing, roughly at the same number. But at least you're holding steady with inflation, and at least you're keeping your powder dry for what should be a very good environment for opportunities in the future. The near end of the Treasury bill curve is the sweet spot, right around 6 months. It's somewhere around 4.7%, 4.8%. It changes day to day, but you're right. It's darn close to 5%. And if inflation is right around there, at least you're holding even. There's no reason to take a lot of risk in a market that's severely overvalued. We think it's severely overvalued. We still think that there's going to be a surprise move to the downside at some point. First stop would be around 3,200. On the S&P, that's a tad over 20% from where we are today. And I think the market has much more downside potential beyond that. Maybe we have another pop here. Like I said just a minute ago, there are some short-term technical indicators that look good. But we're in this permanently overvalued state where you really have to be concerned about downside risk. At the same time, other things are looking good. The chart of gold and silver looking very promising, with gold just above $2,000 an ounce here. It looks, in our opinion, able and ready to move higher to maybe $2,500 an ounce over the next 6 to 12 months. So yeah, it makes sense. If you're sitting in the bank, sitting in low yielding money markets or checking accounts, very easy to get 4 to 5% right now, whether it's in certificates of deposit, short-term treasury bills. You can do treasury bills yourself in a brokerage account. You can do them at Treasury Direct. So there's a lot of different options. So I would say keep your powder dry, get ready for better opportunities in the stock market, and maybe even the real estate market. I know that's been our story for a long time now. I don't think that makes it invalid. I think that it's a slow, lumbering bear market that has been very controlled so far. That's not likely to continue. So just be ready and be safe, because at these valuations, the expected returns on most other things, most notably the stock market, are not positive from here over the next 10 years. They're negative, in fact.
All right. And John, I believe you've got a chart over there talking about the current level of overvaluation in the market here based on historic data.
I'll bring that up in just a minute. I want to first bring up a chart of the S&P 500 just to put in the context some of Mike's comments about, you know, maybe we'll see, you know, a support level at 3,200 and some recent bullish stuff. So let me just share that chart first. And I'll bring it into my main screen here. Can you see that okay?
Yep.
All right. So this is a monthly chart of the S&P 500. It goes way back. This, you know, believe it or not, was the housing bust, right? It looks like a little blip. But you can see here, last year in 2022, we had a pretty strong straight decline. You know, this downtrend line was, you know, kind of was resistance pretty much throughout the year. We had several, you know, bounces throughout the year, but the trend was very much down. This year so far, we've had a bullish breakout above that line. Okay, so that taken on its own is a bullish factor, right? And that's why I want to kind of bring some of the valuations, because a lot of technical analysis, which is this is a form of, really rests on extremes and things like standard deviations and measures of deviations from moving averages and things like that. And the more extreme, you know, 2-3 standard deviations, the more probabilistic a contrary move is. you know, we want to make sure folks don't get blinded by that and forget that we're still in a very, very extremely overvalued broad market. So you gotta make sure you keep the forest from the trees here, or discern the forest from the trees. And even, you know, so Mike talked about a support level at about 3,200. That's roughly that last breakout. But even if you kind of, you know, say, okay, and it's always debatable, are we in a bear market or bull market? And there's different definitions of what that is. But let's take this long-term trend from the 2009 lows. And I'm just going to draw a line here. And there's some guesswork in where you draw this line. But if you draw that line here, you get to like, you know, put those bottoms, you get to about 2,900, 3,000. You know, the market, the S&P right now is 4,100 and change. That's still about a 30% decline from current levels to get to that long-term support line. So, you know, we just want to sensitize folks that, you know, we can get cute with technical analysis, but make no mistake about it. We're still very overvalued, and the longer-term support levels are quite a ways down. So let me pull up that chart that we talked about here. This is a chart of, this goes back to 1880. This was by Doug Short at Advisor Perspectives. So this goes back to 1880. This is a chart put together by Doug Short from Advisor Perspectives. And you can see, you know, this has ranged pretty dramatically. We had, you know, the highest level on this chart was the tech bubble in 2000, well over three standard deviations from its long-term average. Here we are right now approaching two standard deviations after a pullback over the last year. Still very extreme. The only time in history where, other than the recent history, where it's been this is the tech bubble and back in 1929, right before the Great Depression. So talk about extremes. We can't lose sight of the extremity of valuation still. And this is just one measure. There are better measures that are more robust in terms of their predictive power in terms of the future likely returns, which show that we're on par to only twice in history, tech bubble and 1929. So, you know, again, we use technical analysis on a short-term basis, but we never lose sight of the big picture of what's at stake here. And for folks that are out there sitting in passive portfolios, whether it's a 100% stock or 60-40 or 40-60, you know, just be careful. These valuations, we can see 30, 40, 50% decline in the stock market easy from these valuations. And at least there are ways to, if you're going to be intent on being in a portfolio like that, you know, there are ways to hedge that. You know, we use hedging tools all the time. And there are ways to, for example, say, hey, I believe there's 15% upside in the market. Well, let's get that, but let's use some of that, cap the upside at that, and use some of that strategy to bracket or bound or hedge your downside exposure. This is exactly the kind of market where hedged equity we think makes sense for those that are intent on being heavily allocated to equities.
Yeah, we've had a number of experts on this program recently. Again, I'm thinking of Steve Henke most recently from just 2 days ago. Really underscoring the importance for long-term wealth building of minimizing your losses, right? It's like if you can minimize your exposure to losses, then over the arc of time, you're going to be well taken care of, right? Even if you're not, you know, super reaching for gain, and you're not necessarily catching all of the market's upside in a great upcycle. If you're catching some of it, but minimizing your losses, you're going to successfully build substantial wealth over time. And I think that's just a good general rule of thumb in general. But certainly when the times get as distorted as they are right now, and we're still at these extreme levels of valuation, we use the analogy of, you know, picking up nickels in front of the steamroller, you know, all the time. But where the risk return ratio is as unfavorable as it is right now, right, where it doesn't seem like there's a ton of upside left to be gained at these high levels, but potentially a lot of downside if things break, where you just want to be, you know, either somewhere really safe, like, you know, a lot of cash, and or you're employing these hedges that you're talking about, John. And folks, I'll just give my usual recommendation that in most people's cases, because most people aren't familiar with these hedging tools or how to use them, highly recommend you work with a professional financial advisor who does focus on risk mitigation and knows how to use these hedging tools. All right. So, John, I want to ask you one other question, and then, Mike, I'm coming to you on a related topic. So John, you did send me an email the other day just saying you really enjoyed the Matt Pippenberg interview that we did last week, which honestly has been one of my favorite ones that I've done yet for Wealthion, and certainly one of the ones that's gotten the most positive feedback. So there's something specific about that I want to talk about with you, but real quick, I'm just curious if there was any sort of key elements of that video that really struck you as you know, meaningful enough that you reached out to me to compliment me about it.
Yeah. Matt talked about the math doesn't lie. It doesn't lie. You do the math, whether you're talking about the sustainability of our budget deficits or the historical math of what happens when valuations get to the ranges they are, anywhere close they are to where we are now. The math doesn't lie. The math doesn't lie that if you suppress interest rates for a long enough period of time, you're going to get all kinds of misallocation of capital and bad decision making that's, you know, start to boil over in places that you least expect it. And so I just really appreciated his reliance on data and not hope and wishes, but data and a humility. He was humble in saying that, hey, the math doesn't always matter right away, but it will. He also talked about, I think it was him that talked about some of the folks he admires the most in terms of asset managers are those that worry about risk. Not that it's worry about risk and that they're perma bears or anything like that, but there are times where if you worry about risk, you can also answer the question that there's nothing to worry about. But the problem is most of our industry, and he calls it out, and Jeremy Grantham in his interview calls out that it doesn't pay for our industry to be bearish, right? Being perma bullish is what our industry is all about. And I just really appreciated Matt's truthy perspective that there are all kinds of biases in the system that, willfully ignore the math to take that bullish, rosy, glass perspective on things. And that's why we get big blobs from now and again. And the mantra is, well, we couldn't see that coming. Well, you kind of could, because the math spoke pretty clearly that this was a high probability.
Yeah, what I appreciated about it was the combination of that mathematical pragmatic approach, but also marrying it to history. I mean, Matt's definitely a great student of human history, but also economic history. And, he kicked the whole thing off by just saying, look, if you do the math on the debt, we know how the story ends. And we know mathematically, but we also know, throughout history, every time we've gotten into deformations like this on the debt side, they end very predictably, right? So anyways, folks, it's a great discussion. If you haven't watched it yet, I'll put up a link to it here. That would be a great video to watch after this one. But one other thing that Matt said, and this is what I'm coming to you with on, Mike, is again, through his study of the math and the scope of history, he is quite bullish. I hate to use that term bullish because it sounds speculative, but he just thinks that one of the assets that's going to be the most important going forward here as the end game begins approaching is gold, right? And he gives a lot of really practical, pragmatic reasons for why that is. But the analogy he used, I really liked, which he said he grew up playing competitive baseball. And he said, there were nine of us on the field, but we all kind of knew at the beginning of the game which team was going to win. Because he said, really, it comes down to who's got the better pitcher, right? He said, look, I played third base. I got out there. I did what I needed to do. But I knew that if we had a better pitcher than the other team, we were pretty likely going to win the game. And when he talks about, world currencies and stores of value and whatnot, he just says, look, I just see gold as the better pitcher. Over the long arc, it's going to win out. It's going to do the best at preserving value. And in times of crisis, that's where capital is going to flee to. And I just really sort of liked that analogy as gold as the better pitcher. And Mike, as you said, we've crossed an important, at least psychological, price threshold with gold. It's now back above $2,000 an ounce. We're finally beginning to see silver begin to show a little bit of action here, starting to catch up to gold. The miners are still kind of coiling here. I mean, they're doing okay, but they haven't They haven't, we haven't seen the response from them that we expect to see yet, given where gold is headed. So I'm curious, do you see the precious metals complex here kind of looking like a coiling spring that potentially could pop upwards from here? Or is this just, you know, is it too early to make that kind of assessment?
Yeah, I do see the miners and gold itself and silver coiling to some extent. I really like that analogy about the pitcher. You know, if you really want to know what's going to happen in the in a baseball game, at least statistically, you have to know who's pitching. It has more influence on the outcome than anything else. And as far as assets go, really, I really believe that one of the better looking ones, or one of the best looking ones, and one that you can trust is at least in the long run, outside of the hands of control of central bankers, it's going to be real things, real assets, namely gold and silver. And we look at lots of charts every week, and I'll do a quick review of the charts. I talk about it many times on this program, but I will show again the gold chart that, yeah, I really think looks like one of the best charts we have to look at. Now, here's a monthly chart of gold. You know, if you bought gold 20 years ago, you made, you know, close to 7 times your money. You didn't do the same in the S&P. It's actually outperformed the S&P over that period of time. And I think it's only, that outperformance is only going to get more pronounced in the future. And so we've had, this is going back to 2011, this previous top. It's a giant basing, cup and handle formation. This looks pretty messy the last couple of years. As we created this bullish triangle, we had a breakout, and then we had another shakeout to the downside. But here, we have regained, or close to regained, the previous high. Now, some people with a bearish eye might look at this and say, oh, maybe it's a triple top. You know, I don't think so. I think that this was a giant shakeout. I think that we could consolidate here for a little bit. Who knows, before we break out. But once we break out above 2100 or so in gold, I don't think there'll be any question at all. And we could take a look at silver. Silver looks good as well, but it's more muted than gold. And the gold to silver ratio is somewhere around 80 to 1. I haven't calculated it lately. Long term, that average has been much lower, maybe below 50. It's been as low as 15 in the last 100 years. So gold is outperforming silver in terms of the charts, but take a look at silver. All of a sudden, it's back up to 25 or so. And so it's got a lot of catch up. If it were to catch up, the percentage performance of silver would vastly outperform gold. And lastly, let's take a look at the miners. Let's take a look at GDX, for example. And you'll notice, if we just looked a minute ago at that gold chart, gold is at its previous high, and it's about ready to break higher. But look at the gold miners. Gold miners are really lagging. Their performance has been fantastic in the last couple months. One has to wonder if this was just another shakeout here, because the sentiment was really bad in miners back here a few months ago. But since then, we've regained the kind of the pivot point of this triangle. And, you know, if we were to regain the old highs, it would be a big move up to 45 or so. That's not to say it will happen, but right now, gold miners are out underperforming gold. There's times when sentiment is really bullish that miners outperform gold. And so if we were to close this gap here, and certainly if gold itself starts to break out above 2100, we could see some pretty fast appreciation in the miners. And so these charts are amongst the best we see. I mentioned earlier that technology stocks have good looking charts too. We don't trust it. What we do trust is gold, silver, and the miners.
All right. Well, it'll be really interesting to see. We'll obviously be tracking it closely on this program. Just to put a fine cap on what you just said, Mike, gold is performing strong. Silver, not quite as much, but beginning to show some strength. Miners, a similar story. But if we look at how these assets perform historically, when gold moves, silver tends to follow gold and actually generally outperform gold. And the mining complex tends to outperform both of those, obviously, because it's a levered play on the underlying metals themselves. So again, we don't know exactly what's going to happen from here. But if indeed we do see that catch-up process play out from here, we could see some pretty dramatic price appreciation in both silver and the miners over the next couple of quarters, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these moves are on turbo relative to the underlying, you know, both silver and mining shares will both have outsized percentage moves to the upside. If gold were to break to the upside, you could argue that that's also the reverse and that you could have leverage moves to the downside. So,
which we have seen for sure, even
we've seen it
relatively recently during those corrections you were showing. It definitely works in reverse too. Yeah.
We've lived through it. We survived. We were able to defray some of that pain by using hedges last year in particular. The puts that we had, the part of our option collar hedge that protects the downside, that actually defrayed some, but certainly not all of the downside. So we're long-term believers in the sector. We've used different tools and hedges to be able to survive that journey. And it hasn't always been good, but everything's lining up right now. We'll see what happens, but everything's lining up right now and it looks good.
Okay. All right. Well, look, as we wrap up here, John, I'm going to let you have the last word here before I do the final wrap up.
Well, what I'd like to say, and this is speaking to our clients and certainly folks out there who might choose to take you up on the offer to call us for a free consultation. Look, this is our jobs. We worry about this stuff. We're entering. We just had our first taste of like real spring-like weather here. A lot of people want to enjoy their lives. And that's really what, as much as we obsess about markets, our real mission is to help clients become more at peace, less stressed out about their financial picture. Let us worry about it. We have data and tools and discipline that we can do so in a disciplined manner. But, you know, this should be a source of, if there's fear, that if you have fear or stress, it's usually because you're not asking the questions that you should be asking, or you know, a classic human tendency is to kick the can and just put your head in the sand. And we're human too, so we know this. We're not preaching to the choir here. But conversation with a good advisor can, and we'd be happy to have that conversation with folks, certainly with our clients. You know, let us walk you through the things that are stressing you out, and hopefully, summer comes and you can enjoy summer and don't have to worry about the machinations of a pretty complex economy and market situation.
All right, well said. And you make me want to sort of reiterate a message that was delivered by Tom Wheelwright, who's the CPA that we had on the channel a month or two ago. So right now, probably most viewers, if they're like most Americans, you know, are doing their taxes, trying to get them in before April 15th. And, you know, Tom said, look, he's like, the best time to talk to your accountant is not at tax season. Because he said, there's not much he can really do for you at that point in time, but compile your returns for you and hand them in. He said, the best time to talk to your accountant is at the beginning of the year, when he can say, hey, if you do all these things in your financial life, I can really reduce your tax exposure, right? So similar thing with your financial advisor, which is, I'm sure most people just want to get their taxes done and then kind of get into summer mode, right? And not have to worry about this stuff. I would say while you're still kind of arms deep in your own personal finances here, this is a great time, once you've gotten your tax information to your accountant, to sit down with your financial advisor and say, okay, great, you know, I've now got my accountant working for me the way I need him to. What should I be doing over the rest of the year? Or what should I be setting up now so that I can relax, you know, for the rest of the year, where I've got a plan in place with you, my advising partner, that you can execute for me while I focus on the parts of life that matter, my job, my family, you know, maybe being able to enjoy some of this nice weather that we're starting to have. So anyways, folks, it's a good segue into kind of the wrap up here. First is just a reminder, for all the reasons that Michael talked about in this interview, and that John and Mike and I have followed up on here. This is a really challenging time for the average investor to figure out how to navigate. Don't go it alone. You don't have to go it alone. I highly recommend you work under the guidance of a professional financial advisor who takes into account all the macro issues that Michael talked about, and then creates a plan for you and executes it for you. If you've got a good one who's doing that, excellent. You should remain with them. But if you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even John and Mike and their team there at New Harbor, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. Totally free, so it doesn't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a public service they offer to help as many people as possible prudently position in advance of the issues that, you know, Michael thinks might be in front of us here. To go do that, just go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. If you enjoyed having Michael on this program, would like to see him come back on, and as well as other great guests of his caliber, please do me a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. John and Mike, thanks again for hanging with me for another week. Great commentary. Whatever happens over the next week, I know we'll be here deconstructing it for folks and helping them understand it. Thanks so much for your time. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thank you, Adam. Like usual, we enjoyed it very much, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks again, Adam. We'll see you next week.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free, and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth, and because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type, the kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry, the market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-U.S. clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.